Sally Kirkland, and you're listening to KPFK, radio powered by the people. Fiercely independent. 90.7 FM in Los Angeles.
I'm Amy Gastelum. This is Making Contact. This presidential election, most of the coverage is happening in swing states like Pennsylvania. But even states that have been marked as taken by the national Democratic or Republican parties have surprising and sometimes electrifying down-ballot races making headlines. Today, we're talking about how progressive women in Indiana have stepped up despite being overlooked by the national Democratic machine. Come on in. This is the Red State Down-Ballot Chat you didn't know you needed. Stay with us. Today's show is a two-part interview. In the first half, we're talking with Dana Colbert, the executive director of the Indiana Democratic Party. Ms. Colbert is also the 5th district chair for the Indiana Young Democrats. I started our interview asking her how she got involved with politics. She said she always voted and was pretty politically aware, but as far as jumping in herself, she hadn't considered it until...
Honestly, it was when Trump got elected. Seeing him and seeing his rhetoric and thinking back and realizing that my mother was a teenager during the civil rights movement. And being a young Black woman, watching this rhetoric, making those connections, I thought I needed to do something. And I looked around, tried to figure out where would make the most sense to do something. And it was looking at the local level.
Dana plugged in as a precinct chair in Hamilton County, which is just north of Indianapolis. And from there, her rise in the local party was meteoric. She ran for and won county chair in 2021 and recently ended her term.
You were one of the youngest county chairs in the state and one of only a handful of Black women county chairs in the state. And you were doing this in a county that is predominantly white and conservative, which is Hamilton County. Okay, so for our listeners who aren't familiar with Indiana, I want to give some context. Hamilton County sits just north of Indianapolis. It is primarily made up of like wealthy suburbs, places like Carmel and Fishers. Okay, you're nodding. Okay. And besides the wealthy suburbs, Hamilton County also includes rural communities like Arcadia. But the whole county, like I said, is pretty conservative. With all of that context in mind, you're the person that I want to ask, like, what is the point, right? Like, why should people who hold progressive values even try to have a political voice in a place like Hamilton County?
Well, we've heard it a lot in Hamilton County. It has been traditionally, quote unquote, ruby red. But that was before and when Trump got elected. Since 2018 and on, we broke 40% of the vote across all of our state. We hadn't done that before. In 2019, we got 3 Democrats elected, 2 in Fishers and 1 in Carmel at the city council level. You can also look at the Westfield city council elections last year. Alexis Lowry ran for a district. She lost by 24 votes. 24 votes she would have won.
Hey, it's Amy. When I fact-checked this interview, I found that Lowry actually lost by 23 votes.
But those small gains is a neighborhood. If you go out and you talk to your neighbors and get them to vote, we can start to bring more balance back to the local level and build that up to the state level, and then eventually can build it up again to the national level in our national politics here in Indiana. So I think it's incremental change, right? That's the big thing. You have to fight for that incremental change and take those wins where you can.
So speaking of Hoosier Democrats, Destiny Wells is another Democrat woman getting a lot of attention these days, right? She's running for attorney general against Todd Rokita, the Republican incumbent, who's been in the national news for making some inflammatory remarks about a physician who provided abortion care to a 10-year-old girl. He was reprimanded by the Indiana High Court for his remarks. And some say that he not only abused his power in the statement that he made, but that he's really compromised the integrity of the position of attorney general. So is it possible for Wells to win, even if Indiana remains red in the presidential election?
I think Destiny Wells is positioned in a really good place. Voters might not know, you know, okay, who's your attorney general? But they know the name Todd Rokita. So I think once you start to make that connection, voters are like, oh, no, we don't want that representing us. We don't want to continue to be in the news as Hoosiers for terrible things that are coming out of our attorney general's mouth. So I think that Destiny Wells does have a really good opportunity to capitalize on that and make sure that we have somebody who is in that office who is going to fight for Hoosiers and not continue to just fight for culture wars. So I think that a lot of our down ballots, Destiny Wells, as well as Jennifer McCormick and Valerie McCray, do have a good chance of winning.
Okay. What is the easiest way for regular schmegular people to plug into local politics? Like, step one, do this basic thing.
Well, step zero is making sure that you're registered to vote. And you can check that on indianavoters.com. Step one is actually doing your research and seeing, you can look on indianavoters.com on who's on your ballot and finding, hey, you know what, these candidates are running in my area. Let me reach out to them and volunteer. So reaching out to those campaigns that are nearest to you and saying, hey, I want to help. They need people to go out and talk to people on the doors. They need people to go and make phone calls. They need people to help them stuff envelopes. They need people to help with social media. They need your help in a skill that you can provide. They can figure out a way to get you connected.
What else should we know? What's the thing that you're burning to say that I haven't asked you?
There are people in our state, specifically women, who are concerned about whether or not their vote is private. And it is. Your vote is private. So once you go into the voting booth, nobody knows how you're going to vote. So if there are women who are listening who are concerned about their husbands, their fathers, et cetera, knowing how you're going to vote, don't be. Your vote is private. So you can vote however you want once you get into that voting booth.
The fact that you're even saying that is, like, it's really concerning. Why is that the message that needs to be put out? Like, where is that coming from?
Well, I've seen it canvassing. In previous years, we have gone and canvassed, and we've had the woman that we want to talk to, but the man answers the door, and he's like, you know, my wife's not going to vote for you, blah, blah, blah. But why is she on our list then? Because she is going to vote for us. So the husband doesn't know. And sometimes we'd have follow-ups after canvassing, like the wife would come out, say, hey, like, I'm going to vote for you. But it's a quiet affirmation. There are a lot of quiet affirmations from women who are saying that they're going to vote our way. I have heard it from my own experiences canvassing and some of our other folks who are going out and canvassing too. I think it's stemming from, you know, wanting to keep the peace in your own home. I think that's a big part of it. But I think probably part of it is some of the misinformation that's going on. People are very concerned about the integrity of our elections. And so if you're hearing this constantly that, you know, our elections aren't safe and aren't secure, then you're going to start to wonder, well, is my vote going to stay private? So I think that misinformation that's going on is also a key part of why there are women who are concerned about whether or not their vote is private.
Thank you so much for joining us today and spending, you know, some of your precious time at this point in the season talking to us. And we look forward to seeing what happens in Hamilton County, what happens across the state of Indiana in the next few months. Thanks. I'm Amy Gastelum. In the second half of the show today, we're sitting down with Dana Black. Yes, we're talking to two Danas today. It is The Dana Show. Dana Black is a political podcaster and a former candidate.
I'm the loudest mouth in Indiana Democratic politics. And thank you for taking the time to chat with me.
Ms. Black ran for the Indiana House in 2016. She didn't win, but that experience set her on a path to advocacy and public speaking. And she produces the political podcast Turn Left with a special collaborative series called Let's Talk Indiana, where hosts break down Project 2025 for listeners. I've listened to a few of your shows, and the Let's Talk Indiana are like, I was kind of surprised and delighted that the conversation was like so frank You know what I mean? Because I feel like, do you feel like Hoosiers tend to be kind of like, let's be nice above everything else, above everything else. And you're like, but we can't afford to, you know what I mean?
Well, that's the goal. I mean, right now the stakes are so high. And you're right. Indiana likes their politics sweet. I mean, if you take a look at Mike Pence and Pete Buttigieg, ideologically, they're opposites. But if you listen to their deliveries, they're relatively the same. And that's how Indiana likes its politics, which is why I know I will never be an elected official in Indiana, because they're not ready for all of this smoke.
Well, let's talk about it. Like, back in 2016, you ran for Indiana House of Representatives against Brian Bosma, right? So what inspired that move? Talk about that.
Yeah, I was angry. You know, I used to be a TV yeller. I would watch MSNBC and just point and yell at the TV. I've always been passionate about politics, but it was RFRA.
Okay, I'm going to jump in to explain. RFRA is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. It was signed into law in the spring of 2015. In a nutshell, opponents worried that it would allow open discrimination against LGBTQ+ people, which it did. Brian Bosma was House Speaker at the time and played an integral part in getting the bill passed.
And as a person who in the LGBTQ+ community, I'm like, I thought we already went through this public accommodation thing in the civil rights movement. And when I went to go cast a vote against him in 2014, there was nobody on the ballot. Mm. And that angered me because it was like, wait a second, I don't even have a choice here. So in 2016, I got all my ducks in a row and I said, you know what, I'm gonna challenge him. Now, obviously, I didn't get enough votes to take that seat, but that election was a winning election or a campaign, and let me tell you why. One, there were three other women, another woman of color, that came behind me to challenge that seat when no one had ever done it before. Well, it had been a while. I had received more votes than anyone running against him at that time, but then the subsequent women received even more votes than I did. And then from there, I became the deputy chair of the party. I started my podcast and started giving speeches all over the state. So it was a win because people saw the energy that I put into the campaign. And they were like, oh, there's ways for you to do that. So you don't have to be an elected official to have an impact. And that was the lesson I learned. You don't have to be an elected official to have impact. Now instead of focusing in on myself being a candidate, I can help 30, 40 other candidates by amplifying their message.
So during that 2016 time, when you were running and everything, like, what kind of support did you receive?
It's unique. So if I'm a very masculine of center lesbian, so I would wear ties, cufflinks, and I had long locks at the time. And although people felt like my message was strong, they wanted me to change who I was and how I appeared to the world. You know, do you have a shirt? You know, do you have a picture with an open collar? Could you wear makeup? Could you? No, because what I promised myself was when I look in the mirror, I want to like me. I'm not going to change to make other people comfortable. That's silly. Why would I be uncomfortable to make you comfortable? What I found, though, women responded very well to the way I presented myself from a confidence perspective. I wasn't always confident. But if someone's had to say, well, Dana, what is your political base? I would say it was white women. Sometimes black folks would give me a hard time. I've had black supporters who were getting grief because they were supporting the lesbian. But then they, you know, wait a minute. You mean to tell me you think Brian Bosma is going to look out for black people more than me? I had to earn that respect, right? I just didn't assume because I was a black woman and a lesbian that all those different demographics were going to just rock with me. I had to go earn that. And I did that by going into the communities and going to talk to people, knocking on doors. That was like how the support came. I'll never forget standing in line on election day and people saying how excited that they were that they had a Democrat that they can vote for. And that was what it was all about. Giving people an opportunity to have a choice.
You did not win that bid in 2016, no. As we discussed. But besides, you already touched on this generally, how it, you know, what did come out of it. Is there anything you wanted to add to that? Or is there anything like about how that changed you?
When I ran, I was an angry lesbian because of RFRA, you know. But when you are running for the state house, you recognize that there are going to be bills and legislation that you're going to be voting on that impacts the entire state. So I started to learn about the different issues that were happening around the state and the different things that were incredibly problematic to humans. And by the time I finished the campaign, I was an angry Hoosier. And I was like, who is advocating for people? You know, yes, we have Democrats that are out here doing good work, but there's just policies that are being written that are just harmful. And so how did it change me? I am an advocate for humans in Indiana. I don't care what your political affiliation is. If you're in rural Indiana and you don't have a medical facility, I am going to advocate and fight for a candidate that is going to make sure that you have the medical necessities that you need in your rural town, even if you never vote for a Democrat. My real passion now is about how do I support those candidates and how do I elect as many Democrats as I possibly can? Because I know I'm never going to agree 100% with any candidate, but more than likely, a Democrat is going to have policies and vote for legislation that may be 75 to 80% aligned with my values. And that's the most important thing for me. That's how I change. My passion for making sure that there are people in elected positions who are writing good policy.
And that gets to one of my questions, which is like, is there some freedom in running on progressive values in a place that is so conservative that it's sort of neglected by the big Democratic Party machine?
I will say that it's a struggle. I wish they paid more attention. I wish we weren't a flyover state because resources. So I struggle with that aspect. When I was the deputy chair of engagement of the state party, I felt more constricted than I do now, not having a title in the party. And that is because people wanted to restrict my personal opinions. But my philosophy always was, if I have a seat at the table and I'm not advocating for my demographics, then why am I there? What I found, though, the lesson learned was, and I take it, you look at Georgia, a lot of the change that happened in Georgia for Georgia to flip blue had less to do with the party than it did with nonprofit organizations that were working outside of the party apparatus. They were getting people registered to vote. They were getting information out to rural Georgia. And that to me was a lesson. Oh, I don't have to have a title. I can just continue to do the work and I can say what I need to say without somebody trying to check me. Do you know how hard it is being checked? I'm 54 years old. You don't get to dictate to me what I can and can't say, can and can't do. And I'm a grown-ass woman. How are you going to tell me? And that was one of the problems that I had was like, you trying to tell me as a grown-ass woman what I can and I can't do within the party structure? All right, cool. Well, I tell you what, I'll step outside the party structure and I'm still going to do the things that I want to do. I'm still going to amplify the issues. I'm still going to amplify candidates and I can do it on my own terms.
I found your podcast from the Democratic Party website. Yeah. So like there's still love there, but it's like you're still a little bit outside.
Absolutely, there's love. You know, I will always, always promote people getting involved with the party because there's structure there, right? Nothing is perfect. And when I joined the party, I felt like they could use more volunteers versus complaints. So I got involved because I saw some holes that I could feel. And I will always, always say, hey, if there's something you don't like about the party, get involved. And a buddy of mine, Regina Moore down in Bloomington.
I know Regina Moore.
Yeah. She broke down the party and what it means to be a Democrat. You have your elected officials, right, who are Democrats. You also have the party leadership. They are Democrats. But the voters, the rank and file, we are also Democrats. And so when someone says, well, what is the Democratic Party doing to address this issue? You should look in the mirror and say, well, what am I doing? Because I am a part of the party. I am a part of the change, right? And so we're all in this thing. And if we want things to be better, we have to get down. So yes, if you want to get involved, get involved. They need the help. Bring whatever skills you have to the table. Don't try to be Dana. Don't try to be Amy. Be who you are with the skill set that you have. And I promise you, you'll be able to help us in this movement.
Well, speaking of Dana, I did talk to Dana Colbert.
The cooler Dana.
She... she told me to tell you. Oh my gosh, you're talking to the cooler Dana, the cool Dana. So, all right, okay. It goes both ways.
Absolutely. I'm so proud of her. I remember meeting her years ago, watching her take over the Hamilton County Democratic Party, her filling her slate and causing such a ruckus up there that the Republicans were spending crazy money, which they never had to do. Now she's taken over the state party. I am so proud of her. And guys, this woman is a brilliant woman. She's sweet and she's, you know, quiet. She's the quieter Dana. That's for damn sure. But she is brilliant. Do not underestimate her. She's an amazing woman. Yeah,
she's definitely got a backbone. Speaking of Hamilton County and what went down with Dana in leadership there, like, how conservative do you think Indiana is for real? Like, how permanent is our current experience? Like, how much of the idea that Indiana is so ruby red is actually real and true to you? You're shaking your head.
I don't believe so. I don't believe it's as red as people think it is. What I think is that we have a turnout problem. Indiana ranks 50th in the nation in voter turnout. And if Marion County is only turning out 12%, and it's a state of only 7 million, less than 7 million, and a million of them are in Marion County, and we're not turning out, that's the problem. I believe that if we can get people to the polls, get them registered and get them to the polls, and give them a reason, get them excited about who they're voting for, I think things change. For example, 2008. They wanted to call for McCain, but they forgot we have two different time zones. And Evansville and Lake County hadn't closed. And once Lake County came in, again, another blue dot in this state. People need to understand, yeah, there are a lot of counties that are red, but those counties have very low population, right? If we turn out Marion County, Allen County, Lake County, Vandenberg County, St. Joe County, and then the college towns, we win this state. I'm not saying that we neglect any of those other counties, but they just don't have the sheer number of humans. And if you notice, Hamilton County, the more it grows in population, the more purple it is becoming. So where there are people, there are blue. We just have to get them motivated and get them to the polls.
Given the recent excitement over Kamala Harris's, leadership right now, like, what's going to be the effect of that on some of these down ballot? You're nodding.
Yeah, I think it will have a positive effect down ballot. First of all, think about this. In Indiana, we have all women at the top of our tickets. So not only do we have Vice President Harris, we have Jennifer McCormick who's running for governor. We have Valerie McCray who's running for United States Senate. We have Destiny Wells, who's a dear friend of mine, running for Attorney General. We have the opportunity in Indiana to not only make history with our president, but we've never had a woman governor. We've never had a woman Attorney General. We've never sent a woman to the United States Senate. So we have the opportunity. I even believe it's going to happen in our state house. I believe there's House seats and state Senate seats that are going to benefit from what is happening at the top of the ticket. Because honestly, abortion is on the ballot. Women's body autonomy is on the ballot. I think Micah Beckwith is dangerous. He is a person who believes in white Christian nationalism. He believes that we are a Christian nation. He wants to indoctrinate people into believing that we are a Christian nation when the Constitution over and over says, no, we're not. We're a secular nation. And whatever religion you choose to practice, we're going to make sure that you are protected and able to do so. I am more worried about Micah Beckwith as lieutenant governor than I am anything else, because his history of chaos is documented. And he is going to bring chaos to the state house. I think we need to get rid of Ty Rakita. He's the kind of person that goes after an OBGYN who is trying to save the life of a 10-year-old rape victim. He spends more time at the Mexican border instead of at the Kentucky border. We need people who are going to look out for Hoosiers. And these clowns are not doing that. They're trying to score political points and kiss the orange menace ring. When we are at the bottom statistically of pretty much every category that is related to the quality of life here in Indiana. And why are we allowing that to happen? Why do we allow people to put us in positions where we're losing the best and the brightest? IU just had an article out that said that they are sending their OBGYN candidates to other places. So that means women in Indiana are going to suffer.
Especially rural women, especially Black women, yeah.
As you can see, I'm a little passionate about, you know, the policies that are being written and who is in charge of those policies. So, yeah, I get wound up a little bit.
I get it. I mean, because we're living it, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, like for regular schmegular people, like what is step one if they want to start getting more involved in local politics?
Step one, identify what you are passionate about. Because if you know what you are passionate about, I promise you there's a policy or an ordinance that's connected to it, okay? Once you realize what's most important to you, you can either work with a nonprofit grassroots advocacy group, volunteering your time. You can volunteer your time with your local party. They always need help. Trust, know, and believe. They always need help. That is the first place to look. And if you're not sure who your local party person is, go online and Google it. Google is your friend, people. I know that Google is in the news right now for being a monopoly for their search engine, but Google it. If you really, really want to get involved, take the steps to educate yourself. Stop waiting for people to tell you what to do, right? Do you need somebody to tell you how to get up and brush your teeth in the morning? Do you need somebody to tell you how to drive your car to get to work? Find your passion. And that will fuel you when the times get tough. And for me, you know, being a verbal communicator, getting the message out, talking about the issues, hyping people up. You know, I tell people there ain't no better hype person in the state of Indiana. You can find better fundraisers. You can find better organizers. You can find better leaders. But you will never find anybody in Indiana that will hype the crowd and then Indiana's own Dana Black. And I stand on that.
I've seen you, so that I think that's fair. All right, last question is basically this. There's always something that you want to say that I didn't ask you. What is that burning thing that you're like, people should know this, and I didn't know to ask it?
Have some thick skin and be resilient and recognize everything takes time. You know, I remind people, you know, between Seneca Falls and the 19th Amendment was over 75 years. And it didn't apply to all women. So it takes time, you know, from the end of Reconstruction to the 1964 Civil Rights Act and 65 Voting Rights Act. It took time. You know, nothing is instant. You know, society is not a remote control where you can push a button, it turns on and turns off. Be resilient, but find your purpose and bring it to the movement. That's what I got.
Today, we're talking about how progressive women in Indiana have stepped up despite being overlooked by the National Democratic machine. First, we're talking with Dana Colbert, the executive director of the Indiana Democratic Party. Dana Black is a political podcaster and a former candidate. To find links to Dana's podcast,
go online and Google it. Google is your friend, people.
What is good about KPFK, you do get it that it's the people, not the manufacturers that are selling us all the cheap soap and toothpaste and general unhealthy junk, but it's really information that is quite usable. I'm Joyce Clark from Bellingham, Washington. I listen to KPFK as much as I possibly can, and I do support it.
KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and if you're in Bellingham or anywhere else in the world, www.kpfk.org.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for your donations and overwhelming support of this listener-sponsored community radio, KPFK. It is the support of listeners like you that keeps this station strong, fiercely independent, and powered by the people. Thank you from all of us at Pacifica Radio's KPFK 90.7 FM.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK 90.7 FM and kpfk.org.
There are still ways the Republicans are working hard to fix this election. So today we talked to two women who are working on voter transparency. Emily Levy is the executive director of Scrutineers, a progressive, nonpartisan online community dedicated to fair, transparent, accessible, and secure elections. And Marilyn Marks is the executive director of the Coalition for Good Governance, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to transparent government and evidence-based elections. Marilyn is the driving force behind the much-watched Curling v. Kemp lawsuit against Georgia's election officials to rid the state of unverifiable touchscreen electronic equipment.
So thank you, Emily Levy and Marilyn Marks, for joining us on Women's Magazine today. A lot of people have been worried about issues around the voting, but more issues around, you know, gerrymandering and access to voting. But there's apparently other issues in terms of the security of the system. Emily, could you start off with what you think are some of the issues we need to be worried about in terms of the election this November? And maybe you could tell us what are some of the issues that you're working on that people need to know about that people may not be aware about that are a concern about the validity and fraudulence of election this November?
Okay, sure. Thank you so much, Lisa, for having me and having us on today. I have been working since 2004 on issues related to election security and election transparency. And when we talk about transparency, what we mean is whether the public can actually see what's going on enough to know that we can trust the elections. And largely, it's very difficult to see. We have a very non-transparent system because nearly all votes in the United States are counted by computers. So basically, the ballots are fed in and results come back out, but we can't see what's happening in between. And that's really troublesome. There are ways we can do checks on that, but for the most part, the checks that are being done, they vary state by state, but they are nowhere or almost nowhere sufficient to really know that the results of the elections that are being announced match the way that people voted.
And this is a concern, especially in close states, which you had mentioned to me earlier, and I think people know Georgia, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Florida, Texas, Arizona, Nevada.
Wisconsin, yeah.
And we'll get to Georgia in a minute, but I just want to ask, why isn't the Democratic Party doing more about this?
For a long time, the Democratic Party has really taken the position that if people are worried about the election system, they won't vote. And Democrats rely on high turnout to win elections. So we have been discouraged for a long time from really being public about what the problems are with our election system. And then we had in 2020, suddenly the MAGA Republicans calling attention to problems with the voting machines, or the actually prefer not to call them machines because machines are pretty trustworthy, the voting computers, the computers we use to count our votes and in some cases we'll get into to mark our votes. And the Democratic Party has responded to those MAGA claims by saying the opposite. It's like knee-jerk reaction of if they're saying one thing, then the opposite must be true. And frankly, personally, I agree with that on most things, almost everything. However, they had a point about the lack of trustworthiness of computerized voting systems. And it's not just Dominion, the company they've attacked more, which is the second largest vendor of voting systems in the country, but also with ES&S, which is the by far the largest vendor in the country. So I would really like to see both of the major parties, and I think small parties would join them and independent voters would join in as well, saying, if we can't trust these systems, or even if large numbers of voters don't trust these systems, what we need to do is make the system more transparent so that everyone knows that the winners really won and the losers really lost.
Is there any proof of this? And if there isn't, how do you know this is the case? And how do you know the Democrats are concerned if they're not saying they are?
That's a great question. So some has to do with quiet conversations that happen kind of behind the scenes. I've learned enough being in this work for a while that what politicians say publicly is politics. You know, it's about what they want the public perception to be. It's about who they are beholden to, and not necessarily always what they really think.
Okay, well, let's go to Maryland for a minute and hone in on some of the problems in Georgia. What's going on in Georgia that's important to voters nationally, and why is Georgia's election security particularly of concern, Marilyn?
Thank you, Lisa, for having me. And Emily has it just right in everything she told you there. Now, Georgia is back in play as a swing state. In fact, the Republican pundits say for Trump, it is a must-have state. So think about how the Republicans are thinking of a must-have state on his attempted path back to the White House. And why is it a scary in particular? Because we have Republicans operating a system that is the worst system in the country. It is the most non-transparent. It is a statewide system, unlike California, for example, where every county controls their own system. They choose a certified system. They program that system and the ballots, and they audit the results. In Georgia, no. The Secretary of State chooses the system. He has chosen a bad one. His office programs every single voting machine that the voters use to input their votes. His office consolidates the tallies and does whatever make-believe audits they do. What's wrong with this system, other than the fact that there is a single point of failure, unlike California, we just said, and most states are very much like California. What's wrong with this? In Georgia, they have chosen a system that you don't mark your ballot with a pen to color in the oval. Instead, you put your vote choice on a touchscreen, and it comes out in a QR code. And then that QR code on a piece of paper is fed into a scanner. So when the voter votes, he may be voting for Harris, and that QR code may say Trump, and that voter has no idea that he just voted for Trump. And there is no real way to check, is the shorthand. And the system is quite hackable. And the reason it is, it's hackable by nature, as the DHS's cybersecurity group has confirmed that it is quite hackable. But even further, Trump's allies stole the Georgia software in 2021 and have distributed it to a bunch of bad actors. They can easily use it to corrupt the system 2024 in an undetected way. And the Republicans in charge of the state election board and the governor's office and the Secretary of State have done nothing about it, Lisa.
And what are you guys doing to help protect us down there, Marilyn Marks, down in the Coalition for Good Governance? I imagine there's probably other organizations, too. What do you think can be done?
Well, we have sued the Secretary of State and the State Election Board in a seven-year ongoing battle. We've gone to trial. We are awaiting the judge's order, but it won't come out in time for the election, we're afraid. Been waiting for that order for some time. And that would have taken the state to handmark paper ballots with audits that you could at least verify the result. What we've done in the meantime, and this is where perhaps we could use the help of your listeners, and that is we are prevailing on the state election board through its rulemaking to say that because of the lack of mitigation and compromise of the system, that as an emergency measure this year, we must use handmarked paper ballots. And that would solve this problem of malware in the system. It would then be detected. And, you know, worst comes to worst, you've got every voter's choice on a paper ballot that can be, if you had to do it, you wouldn't necessarily need to do it. But if you had to, you could always hand count. We are not proposing hand counts. Machines can count them. But as Emily said, humans need to check the machines.
Well, can you tell me a little bit more about what's in your brief that you argue? Was it the aspect of the stolen? And tell us a little bit about the stolen election software.
Right. In our long-running case, and we'd had 17 days of trial, we were basically proving that Georgia's system, by all accounts and all cybersecurity experts, is insecure even before the software was stolen, that it is very hackable. And if you hack it, you can't detect that it was hacked. It can produce wrong results. That was the core of the case. But in preparation of the case, I discovered, Lisa, that Trump's allies had, in an order that came from the Oval Office in the, quote, unhinged meeting that took place in December 2020 when Trump was still in the White House, they decided they were going to go get access to Georgia's software. They got it through so-called friendly means. It was just an election official allowed them to steal it. They have had it all of this time and distributed it to bad actors with good technical skills who can do anything they want to with it. And so that is the core problem here. Your readers can read about the details of this if they Google Coffee County election theft or Coffee County software. Lawfare in particular has done some in-depth studies or in-depth articles. Washington Post has done about 8 articles on it. It will explain to your readers the very scary story of Trump's people having the software and what they can do with it.
And that issue has made its way into Fani Willis's RICO case in Georgia. So if you've heard of Coffee County and you're like, oh, that might be familiar, that's probably why you've heard of it. And that's as a result of the work of Marilyn and the Coalition for Good Governance.
Can you explain that more? What do you mean it's gone into her? Can you draw that out a little bit?
Marilyn?
Yes. Okay. So most people know Fani Willis as the Fulton County, Georgia district attorney with the very famous case right now where she indicted Trump and 18 other defendants on fake electors. Then, you know, the call that was made to Raffensperger by Trump asking to find him 11,000 and something more votes. And then the third part of that indictment is for the theft of the software and the racketeering conspiracy that was involved in stealing that software. And we were able to give to Fani Willis all of our discovery work from which she then was able to have the grand jury indict a number of people. And most of your listeners would have heard that Sidney Powell pled guilty to something along these lines. Yes, Sidney Powell was the one who paid for the people to go in and copy the software. She's pled guilty. And then one of the other guys who was involved, Scott Hall, a bail bondsman, he's pled guilty. But there are several others that we're ultimately expecting to see plea deals come from for this. But it hasn't caused the Secretary of State to do anything about the problem. No mitigation.
And why is that?
You know, I hate to be cynical, Lisa. The powers that be in Georgia right now, from the Attorney General to the Governor to the Secretary of State, are all Republicans. And it really upsets the base, if you will, if their officials start going after Trump and Trump allies on criminal charges.
So this is part of the reason why the Republicans have been trying to undermine Fani Willis, so because of this part of the information?
Well, probably anything. You know, she could charge him with jaywalking and they'd be mad at her. But, you know, yes, that is absolutely one of the reasons that they don't want the criticism or indictments of Trump and his allies.
We're talking to Emily Levy, who's an executive director of the Scrutineers.org, a progressive nonpartisan online community dedicated to fair, transparent, accessible, and secure elections. And Marilyn Marks for the Coalition for Good Governance, who's working on Georgia's election security, which is in particular a concern because it is a swing state. Marilyn, can you tell us why what's happening in Georgia is important to the rest of the country?
So, Lisa, as your listeners probably know, Georgia has now become a swing state again, and it is really important to the Republicans to win Georgia. We have Republicans in charge of all of this software. They've got their hands on the software. There are so many problems. It is just begging for manipulation and at least claims of manipulation, if not manipulation. And unfortunately, with this system, you can't tell the false claims from the true claims. So as the nation focuses on Georgia as an important swing state, the credibility of and the verifiability of Georgia's election, it could really be the tipping point. And that is why everybody needs to keep their eye on Georgia and help us where you can on trying to persuade the state election board to do the right thing.
Well, just now that you piqued my interest, is Stacey Abrams aware of this and working on voting issues this 2025?
She's certainly aware of it, but she has really not been engaged in these kinds of things in a few years. Some years ago, she was absolutely on the case of we need hand-marked paper ballots and not touch screens. But she's not been involved in that in recent years. And I believe that Emily had it right when she says that for Democrats, and I'm paraphrasing Emily, but that it has not, that it has become an issue they're afraid to talk about. And, you know, as a result, because they're afraid to talk about it, then they're not recognizing the risk. They call the Republicans election deniers, and some of our experts call the Democrats vulnerability deniers. And so we've got the middle, that the truth, the science that is just not being dealt with.
And you don't see any change with Kamala Harris, new candidates up for election?
You know, I have hopes. It's, of course, going to be very hard to get to Kamala Harris right now. However, when she was in the Senate, she was the strongest advocate in the Senate, either Republicans or Democrats, on secure system hand-marked paper ballot. She was a real advocate and the strongest and best. It's not been her focus, but we're working hard to try to get the word up to the right people there who might be able to encourage the Democrats in Georgia to step up and say, okay, it is a real problem.
As much of a mess as Georgia is, one thing that's great is that it has in its laws provisions for emergency paper ballots. And if this isn't an emergency, I don't know what is.
Amen.
Do you want to tell us, Emily, how election fraud issues might be important in other states besides Georgia?
Yeah. So as I said before, nearly every vote in the United States is counted by computers, and those are software-based. They can produce whatever results they're programmed to produce, regardless of how people vote. The only way we can trust them is if there are really robust checks on those systems. Basically, it's a black box that where our votes are counted, and there are some tiny windows into that black box that, for the most part, no one is looking into. And so that's what we do, is we teach people at Scrutineers, we teach people how to provide public oversight that is basically looking in those windows into the black box and performing the checks and balances that the government really should be performing and isn't. So one example of that is observing the processing and counting of votes that happens in election offices or designated facilities around the country in the hours and days and up to a couple of weeks after elections. And we teach people how to do that, how to prepare to observe, what to look for, what to do if they see problems, what are the kinds of things they might see that they think are problems and aren't, what are things that might seem fine and really are problems. It's not always common sense. So we teach people how to do that and encourage people to observe everywhere. It's most important in the places that use these touchscreen systems to vote. And it's most important in places where the election is really close, where a small error, we're not even talking about hacking or rigging, but even errors happen. Elections are really, really complicated, and it's hard to get them right all the time. So in places where the elections are close, small errors could go undetected if no one is there watching, if the public isn't there watching, because election workers are extremely overworked and also underpaid, and they're now being harassed by the MAGA faction of the Republican Party and are really in an impossible situation. And it's very hard to do your best work under conditions like that. So we want people to be in support of election workers going in and observing what happens before and during the election, as well as after. After is a time when most people kind of stop paying attention. Like a lot of the voting rights organizations that are doing amazing work in getting people registered, getting people to check their registrations to make sure they haven't been removed from the voter rolls, getting out the vote. That's the focus of most of the voting rights and election protection movement. And there's not enough attention being paid to what happens to those votes after they're cast. So we're trying to fill in that gap.
Okay, so we're almost out of time. I just want to know, is this important in California and what could people do locally? And then I will give both of your organizations information that people can contact you to volunteer.
Great. So yes, it's important in California, and a lot of people in California feel more secure about our elections here. And I understand that. Also, when it comes to the presidential race, people tend not to be concerned about which way California's votes are going to go, or Democrats tend not to be concerned, I should say. There are races in California that are close and important. There are some House races, so people can travel to those counties if they, you know, live in the Bay Area, for example. I'm in Santa Cruz, but a lot of your audience is in the Bay Area. They can become poll workers. There are also possibilities to help with what's going on in other states from home. And that's one of the things we teach people to do in Scrutineers. Also supporting our organizations by volunteering to use your skills, whether they be creating video or social media or fundraising or that kind of thing. Both our organizations need those types of help, as well as financial support for the work that we do. So there are lots of opportunities to help both in California and from California with what's going on in other places.
And Marilyn, just quickly, is there anything you wanted to say as we wrap up of how people can get involved?
I underscore everything Emily said, but most urgently, we could use some very short letters to Georgia's State Election Board asking them to go to hand-marked paper ballots for in emergency balloting for November. And if your listeners would just text me at 704-292-9802, 704-292-9802, or email me at marilyn@uscgg.org, marilyn@uscgg.org. I will send you a few sentences long letter, and it would be really helpful to send it to the State Election Board asking for this help. They will be hearing this issue in the next few days, and to hear from others around the nation that this is something important to the nation would be really helpful, Lisa.
Is there anything you didn't get to say that you really feel you need to say?
One quick thing is that we've got an event coming up that's an introduction to this work. People can find out more about it at our website.
Okay, great.
It's an online event.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. I really appreciate both of you, what you're doing, and for making time for this. I wish we had a bigger audience. I wish I was the New York Times, and I hope they cover it. I hope you're reaching out to them.
We talk to them all the time, but they are in the progressive mode of, we just can't talk about this. It's too scary.
That was an interview with Emily Levy and Marilyn Marks. And you can go to scrutineers.org for more information about how to support election transparency in California. And you can get more information from Marilyn Marks about her work in Georgia around election transparency at marilyn@uscgg.org. Or you can go to the group's website, which is coalitionforgoodgovernance.org.
Senses open, imperfection to be mine. my crime. In humility, I will listen. We're all swimming to the other side. We are living in the great big dipper. We are washed by the very same rain. We are swimming in the stream together, some in power and some in pain. We can worship this ground we walk on, cherishing the beings that we live beside. Loving spirits will live forever. We're all swimming to the other side. On this journey through thoughts and feelings, binding intuition, my head, my heart, I am gathering the tools together. I'm preparing to do my part. All of those who have come before me, band together and be my guide. Loving lessons that I will follow. We're all swimming to the other side. We are living beneath the great big dipper. We are washed by the very same rain. We are swimming in the stream together, some in power and some in vain. We can worship this ground we walk on, cherishing the beings that we live beside. Loving spirits will live forever. We're all swimming to the other side.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. And thanks to all of the contributors today. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. You can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook and on Instagram, or just email us at feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play. Thanks for listening.
Radio Insurgencia Femenina, programa realizado por y para la mujer que lucha día a día para salir adelante.
Las ideas de ti van a decir cosas muy feas, que no eres buena, que si tal cosa.
Support comes from the Luckman Fine Arts Complex, presenting the UK's preeminent gospel ensemble, the Kingdom Choir, Saturday, November 16th at 8 p.m. Known for their acclaimed performance at the Royal Wedding, the Kingdom Choir brings their joyous spirit to the Luckman in their new holiday show, A Kingdom Christmas. For more information, visit luckman.org and kpfk.org.
To be thankful for. If you're thankful for the old family vehicle, you can let it help one more time by donating it to the KPFK Vehicle Donation Program. The proceeds will help KPFK continue the quality programming you depend on throughout the year. The vehicle donation number is 877-